This is the second part of the second class, and we got as far as 1966. Zambia. Yes, I was about to tell you what's happened to Zambia. This is a little difficult to explain, really. Zambia threatened to leave the Commonwealth in 1966. Why did they threaten to leave the Commonwealth? Well, because of the one of the few countries which had not become independent in Africa was Rhodesia, which today is known, of course, as Zimbabwe. And this was a this will be a complicated story, which will continue for the whole of the 1970s. The question of Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, but basically Rhodesia. At the time, had a parliamentary system where the rights to vote of black people were almost non-existent. The British government was being, in the opinion of Zambia, too friendly to the white government of Rhodesia. And so Zambia threatened to leave the Commonwealth. This is just one episode in a long story because British government will tell the white government of Rhodesia that they are unhappy, that they want to move towards a system where black people can also vote. But at the same time, one of the reasons for this will be because the influence of Britain with the black countries is threatened by their friendship with this white supremacist government. And that will continue throughout the 70s. We will see it again, and it will lead to a lot of conflict. 1967 brings in a few events which will I've chosen because of their future. First of all, I can't see why I've got that. I think that is the actual practical beginning of BBC Two. I think that's it, yeah. I think that's what it is, but I'll check that in a moment. On the right, you see Caja Dros yr Iaith. This is a leaflet in Welsh, and it is there to symbolise the fact that the Welsh Language Act was passed in 1967. Tremendously important. Indeed, throughout the 1970s, the Welsh nationalism and Scottish nationalism, and at least two different nationalisms in Northern Ireland, will be important political tendencies. However, they are all a little different, and Scottish nationalism is different, for example, from Welsh nationalism. Why? Well, do you remember? Stop me if I told you this last week. I don't think I did, though. Do you remember when did Scotland join the United Kingdom? 1707. Do you remember how? Yeah. But the fundamental answer is by negotiation. In 1707, the Scottish elite negotiated with the English elite. Scotland had some good arguments. The Scottish elite had some good arguments. Says, if you don't give us good conditions for joining the United Kingdom, we're going to join France. That was the real argument, yeah, and it was a real possibility. And that would have been very, very dangerous for England. So they got a fairly good deal, the elite. They said, we want to keep our own church, Presbyterian church, no bishops, English elite. Okay. We want to keep our own education system, separate education system, different diplomas and so on. Okay. We want to keep our own legal system. Okay. And even today, the Scottish education system and the Scottish legal system have always been different from the English one. For example, if you are accused of murder in Scotland, don't do this, okay? But if you are accused of murder in Scotland, the trial can give three possible results: guilty, not guilty, or not proven. And this is the only legal system in Europe that has three possible results in criminal trials. That's just an example, you know, and it's fascinating in its own way. But basically, because the Scottish elite had some power, they got a compromise. Absolutely different from the Welsh. The Welsh were conquered militarily in the 12th century, and opposition was crushed. If you go to Wales along the border, there are these enormous castles with, you know, with walls 5 foot thick, because although the English had conquered it, they didn't feel very safe, so they had these huge castles. And therefore, well, Wales and England have had the same education system, the same legal system, the same religious domination for many centuries. And therefore, the demand in Wales for Welsh independence is very small, whereas the demand in Scotland for Scottish independence has been growing since the 1960s. In Wales, the nationalism is mostly built around the defence of the language, because the Welsh language is, first of all, is spoken by far more people than the Scottish. It's really a flourishing language. And that is why the 1967 Welsh Language Act was so important. The Welsh Language Act gave some rights to Welsh speakers to use Welsh in courts. That is to say, in tribunals, they could use Welsh if they wished. Since the middle of the 16th century, only English had been allowed, and indeed for a good part of this, in schools it was not allowed to teach, or even to speak Welsh in schools, etc. So there was a language oppression going on, and this was the first step. This symbolic move will be taken further by a new Welsh Language Act under John Major in 1993. And today the situation is, the Welsh language is in quite a strong position. If I wanted to get a job in a university in Wales, I would almost certainly have to show I was learning Welsh. Otherwise I wouldn't get the job. Yeah. So there's been a slow movement towards a recognition of the Welsh language. And these nationalism, Welsh nationalism, Scottish nationalism, will become more important in the 1970s, in particular because the traditional constituencies of the Labour and the Conservative Party will be unstable and people will be tempted by the nationalists, which will lead sometimes to them having the role of kingmaker in the Parliament. Otherwise, on the top left, you can see an advert in a newspaper for the North Western Homosexual Law Reform Committee. The committee's representative will give personal advice to anyone with difficulties arising from the homosexual condition. Now, at the time, these were tremendously progressive people, although if you look at now, you have the homosexual condition, it makes it sound like an illness, you know. In 1967, the Sexual Offences Act decriminalised homosexual acts between men in private, providing they were over 21 years of age. However, what were the reasons for this law? The reasons were not as progressive as you might think, in fact. The first thing is, this is the Labour government that brought this in, and obviously this is an important reform, which will be the beginning of a very long process, the most recent thing is that 2 years ago, a Conservative government in Britain passed the Equal Marriage Act. A Conservative government... impossible. It seemed to be impossible. However, in the 1960s, general attitudes and elite attitudes were much less progressive. One of the reasons for the act was that there were more and more problems with blackmail, because it was illegal to be homosexual. That this caused a whole number of problems. First of all, the suicide rate was very, very high. Secondly, and it was a very, very difficult time to live. You know, you had to memorize the if you had friends with telephones, you had to memorize their phone numbers because you couldn't write them down, because if the police got you, then they get your friends. You know, it was a very, very heavy situation before 67. But really, the fact that that politicians and other powerful people could be blackmailed was one of the reasons that made the Parliament want to pass this law. Interestingly enough, it was not in the Labour manifesto. There was an election in 1964 and another one in 1966, and the Labour Party wrote the manifesto, and they didn't promise to change this law. But then they changed it. Now, why didn't they promise to change it? Well, because they thought that they wouldn't win votes by promising, they would lose votes by promising to change this. That's probably true. That's probably true, they probably would. Also, partly because the Catholic minority in Britain, about 10%, are generally working class and Labour voters, And so there was a bit of tension around around that. Same thing for the this is also the year of the Abortion Act, where abortion becomes legal. The Abortion Act, the motivation was slightly different. It was really for public health reasons. The number of women dying from illegal abortions was just really very, very high, you know. And so you got to the point where the government said that was the major problem. But in general, these two laws are both part of a slow trend where it becomes accepted that the government's job is not to deal with the moral lives of the citizens. And so more and more people say, well, yeah, well, you know, I think that's a very bad thing to do, but, you know, it's not a question for law. And that's been seen more recently as well. All the for the Equal Marriage Act, for example, in the British Parliament, if I remember correctly, all the Catholic MPs and all the Muslim MPs in Britain voted in favour of equal marriage 2 years ago. I think it was all except one or something like that. This is because it's become more and more accepted that there's moral codes which are individual decisions and that the law is something else. This will also be the case in the changes in divorce laws. For a long time, to get a divorce, you had to prove that somebody was wrong, somebody was making the other one suffer. And gradually you will get to the situation where it's possible to divorce and say, well, you know, you don't have to give a reason. Yeah. Ah, no, sorry, this is not about BBC Two. It's in colour. Sorry, I didn't know it's in colour. The very first colour televisions went on sale in 1967. I thought there was something weird about it. It's in colour. That is very weird. The colour televisions became the majority of televisions in 1975. So the price of television is actually going down slowly. Yeah, every year it's a bit cheaper. Just like computers. Yeah, computers at the beginning were really expensive. You know, now really they're relatively cheap, although if you don't have money. And I have a little quote here in considering these different laws, you know, the Race Relations Act, the legalisation of homosexuality, the Abortion Act. The period of Labour government from 1964 to 1970 saw the introduction of a series of changes in the law of inestimable benefit to minority groups, as their supporters claims, or moves towards a permissive and decadent society, as their opponents argued. They constituted a series of social reforms that changed the quality of life for many millions of people. Okay, that's just a little quote there. This is an expression you don't hear anymore, but you heard a lot in the 1970s, the permissive society. I haven't heard it for 20 years, but in the 1970s this was considered by conservatives, mostly by conservatives, to be a danger. And in many ways, people still had bigger families than today, and the family values were different and more traditional. I remember fewer women went to work. And I remember when I was a child, they used to have an expression, a latchkey kid. I don't know if you heard this expression, a latchkey kid. And a latchkey kid is a child who goes to school, and when they come back from school, they have a key to their door around their neck, and they have to open the door themselves and go in. And this was considered to be very, very sad and bad. Because the mother was working. So the poor child had to go home, and there was nobody there. So this was the actual expression for it, a latchkey kid. Yeah. But and remember, at the time, we didn't say single parent families, we said a broken home. Yeah, it's not the same idea, is it? A broken home. I remember this. You know, in the 70s, you said, "Oh well, you know, I know he's causing trouble, but you know, he's from a broken home." It does have a funny side to it today. It wasn't really necessarily that funny at the time. I wasn't from a broken home, and I wasn't a latchkey kid either. This is so big changes here. Remember, we don't yet have frozen food. I mean, it's very often considered to be a good thing to have both parents going out to work, even if only because you get two wages. But it's easier when you have frozen food. And it's easier when you have central heating and a washing machine. Because housework used to take up a lot more time than it does today. Although I'm told it still takes up a lot of time today. 1968, then, two big events in 1968, one of which will really, well, certainly the one on the left will really echo its way down the ages. People still talk today about Enoch Powell. He died a few years ago. And he gave his, what did he do in 1968, do you know?
His speech. Yeah, Rivers of Blood.
Yeah, he gave his famous Rivers of Blood speech, which is the sort of speech you have to read, in which he claimed that white people in Britain were typically mistreated by black people, and that the future of a mixed race society must be horrific and bloody. And that's what, you know, I can see, yeah, if we continue, I can see in my mind, I can see rivers of blood. That's the thing. In fact, it's a quotation from some Roman guy, Virgil. So a very, very racist and shocking speech. We could also see that, you know, not just from a moral point of view, but from a practical point of view, he was quite wrong, because there are London is more mixed race today than it has ever been. And the last time I was there, I missed the rivers of blood. You know, maybe they were somewhere else. You know, so it was certainly a closed-minded way of seeing relations between different ethnic groups. He couldn't imagine that things could be okay. I mean, I'm not saying everything's wonderful, you know, but you know, he couldn't imagine that at all. It was also very opportunistic, because he hadn't always been a terrible racist. He had been to the West Indies in the early 1950s. He went to the West Indies to recruit West Indians for the buses in London. So he was a bit opportunistic. He suspected that there were a lot of people who had this opinion, and if he put it forward, this would help him. The speech itself is full of anecdotes, some of which have been proved to be invented, and others of which are no doubt invented, partly because they're too perfect for his argument. He was a very, very good speaker, but they're just too perfect, you know. If we ever look at the speech, we can go into this. Now, he chose his timing badly. Because when he gave this speech, he lost his job as shadow minister, because he was going too far for the Conservative government. However, he mobilised a high level of minority support, and a series of dockers and immigration officials went on strike to support Enoch Powell when he was sacked. So this was a major political crisis. Because although of course, the Conservative Party was in opposition, and although the Conservative leader said, "Oh, I don't want you to be shadow minister anymore, because you know these are ideas are beyond the pale," nevertheless, he had a powerful minority who were prepared to organise strikes to support him. Now, it's not that easy to get people to organise strikes to support you when you're a politician. Any politician, you know, it's very, very, very rare. You know, but there was obviously a very well-organised minority, or a very vociferous minority. 1968 is also the year when the Church of Scotland authorised the ordination of women, and this will be one of a very long series of firsts for women in the United Kingdom, and I will show you several times during the 1970s the first woman to do this, the first woman to do this, and there are many, many of them in the 1970s. And of course today, in the Church of England has women priests, and I think about 20% of priests, for Anglican priests, are women now. It's about 20%. Those are an excellent 1980s sitcom about a woman priest in the Church of England, and what's it called? The Vicar of Dibley, and Dibley is a very small village, very conservative, and unfortunately their priest has died, and so they're waiting for the new one to come, and of course they don't know that it's a woman.
This is in a Presbyterian church.
The Church of Scotland, yes.
Is that main Presbyterian, or is it
It's Presbyterian, yes. The Church of Scotland is Presbyterian, yeah. That fundamentally means they don't have bishops. So, presbyter means committee, and so each parish is run by a committee. Although in Scotland they have a number of different, they have a huge number of Protestant churches. It's almost like America, you know. They have if you get angry, you found a new church. 1969, very important moment, 1969, because it is the discovery of oil in the North Sea. A lot of oil. So this was something which is going to make a big difference to the British economy. Britain was mostly dependent on what kind of energy?
Coal.
They have a lot of. There was a lot of coal. There still is a lot of coal under Britain, but there are no coal miners anymore. So coal was essential. For example, if you had gas at home in the 1960s, it was what we call town gas, which is made from coal. And during the 1970s, my father, who was a gas worker, during the 1970s and 1980s, he went round to people's houses to adapt them for natural gas, which comes from the North Sea. Now, this oil will have a huge effect on the United Kingdom, although most of the money which comes in will come in the 1980s, because, of course, it takes time. Yeah, and so, in fact, Margaret Thatcher will benefit massively from the money coming in, you know. It will also have a tremendous political effect on Britain, because it is off Scotland. And the Scottish nationalists, who are already beginning to become more influential, they're much smaller than today, but they're already beginning in the 1960s to become more influential, so they say, hey, that's Scotland's oil. And they will build big political campaigns around the idea that Scotland should benefit from this oil. Probably those who benefit most from the oil were multinational companies, because certainly the different governments were perhaps some more than others, but they were very, very generous to the companies. They didn't ask for a lot of tax. And you have a picture in the middle, which is showing what happened to how many billions of. Millions of barrels per day. How many millions of barrels per day? And there you have the number of Texan, and then the number for North Sea. So you can see that the peak for North Sea oil was in 1999. It's been going down. There's still quite a lot of it around. So this is big money. This is big money. Huge amount of money there. 1969 is also a key turning point for Northern Ireland. The rioting in Derry, fighting between Catholics and Protestants, and more specifically, more attacks on Catholic parts of town by Protestant militia. And the government decides to send the British Army in to keep the peace. At the very beginning, the Catholics welcomed the British Army because they were under attack. And, you know, many people were killed and houses burned and so on. But quite quickly, the British Army came to be seen as allies of the Protestant-dominated provincial authorities against the Catholic population. We will have time to go into this more, but the situation in the 1960s in Northern Ireland is one of tremendous inequality and discrimination. Many Protestants have two votes, for example. You know, it's very basic stuff, yeah? Because you get a vote... every citizen gets a vote, and then you get a vote if you own a business. But practically all the businesses are owned by Protestants. You know, so it's a kind of indirect discrimination. You know, so something very, very solid. And so it's not surprising that when the Catholics organised protests, they called themselves the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, absolutely inspired from the United States. And that's just one of the examples, but it's true that when you say, hey, they have two votes and we have one vote, it's fairly basic stuff. But in general, I mean, this goes back to the colonial situation of Ireland, but it was getting more extreme in the 1960s. Certainly, in 1969, if you had a problem, you live in a Catholic area of town and you have a problem and you call the police, this is just because you're stupid. They will come and beat your children and go away. You know, it would be absolutely stupid to call the police. The population was 45% Catholic, and the police was 100% Protestant. 100. So, in fact, when they changed the recent compromise, things have got much better today. And when they reorganized the police in 1998, they decided to establish a committee for recruiting new policemen, because they didn't trust the police to recruit new policemen. So they set up an independent committee which recruited 50% Catholics and 50% Protestants. Yeah. So that's how, let's say, it was a very rigidly entrenched. And one of the strange things about Northern Ireland is, although the Protestants are white and the Catholics are white, you have all the normal, boring, horrible signs of everyday racism. You can have racism without being a different colour. This is the moment when the British troops go in, and it's supposed to be temporary, but they stay for a long time, and that will be one of the main events of the 1970s, will be that there will be, I think during the 1970s, 2,000 or 3,000 people are killed in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Although, we need to be a little bit careful with the numbers of killed, because it may not be the main event. That is to say, for example, the IRA destroyed many, many commercial and banking facilities. Their aim was to be expensive. And so, although, of course, it's important to count the number of people who died every year, that doesn't necessarily explain very much, because, in fact, the aims could be quite different. The whole Northern Ireland saga will go on through the 1970s. The British government will be condemned for torture. The IRA will plant bombs in Britain, in Birmingham, and civil war does not bring out the best in people, let's say. Okay, and so there you are now entering Free Derry. You can still see this in Derry. It's symbolic. This means that on the other side of this building, the police cannot come and the army cannot come, because they dare not, because we are the Catholic community and we're keeping them out. Oh, I just did that one. So we're now at the 1970s. So the summary of this, from the point of view of political leadership, is what I was mentioning last week. Should we talk about the post-war consensus? I said I preferred to say post-war settlement, because that suggests that people don't agree, but they accept. And the other expression that you might see around is futskillism. Do you remember this expression? It's the idea that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are very similar. And at the time, a journalist invented this name because the Conservative leader was Butler and the Labour leader was Gateskill. And he said, this is futskillism. That is, that the Labour and the Conservatives are in agreement on these important issues. And so, of course, this is not completely false, but in any case, it will all break down in the 1970s. And the reason that the 1970s has been chosen for a question for your aggregation is because everything explodes. Yeah, that's what it's an interesting time. Yeah, it's an interesting time. Although it has to be said that the Wilson years, 1964 to 70, it was an aggregation question about 15 years ago. I also like the 1970s because I was a teenager. I mean, the best time it is to be a teenager, isn't it? Isn't it? I suppose so. I'll ask my daughter. She's now a teenager. Okay, which brings us to Britain and the crisis in the 1970s. So I'm now moving on. I'm still staying for the time being with the chronological approach, but I'm also going to give you some statistics. Because I think statistics are important. In 1970... Oh, sorry, before we start. What I would like to have is that... I would like to have it so that it told me what was coming next. I wonder if we can do that. No, I can't, can I? There's a way to do this, but I can't do it. Now I've just got onto the wrong one all completely. Okay, never mind. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Can you still read it there? Yeah, just to give you an idea how long ago the 1970s was, do you know what these are? My goodness me, I feel old. Well, in 1970, a calculator, you know, a calculator was really, really expensive. Nobody had a calculator. And this is what you had instead. Okay. At the top, this is a logarithm table, which is a way of calculating, it's a way of multiplying or dividing by transferring it into addition and subtraction. This was a method which was invented in the 17th century by a Scotsman called Napier, and was used in all schools from the 17th century until 1975, or even later. When the invention of the pocket calculator meant it was no longer necessary. So that's quite a big change, really. I mean, this is the very, very beginning of the computer age. The 1970s is not the computer age, really, but it's the very, very beginning when you saw a pocket calculator and you pressed the button, look, 12 times 50 equals, look at the top, it says 600. It's absolutely incredible. It's appeared to be absolutely incredible. And of course, they're now... Well, you do it with your telephone, you know. It's not. You don't even buy a machine separately. Below is a slide rule, which is the same thing, but in a quicker method. So basically, you say, you know, 7 times 2, and then you get the answer here if you move it up and down. I could explain the maths to you, but I'm not going to. But I could. Just to give you an idea, what was the 1970s before? Obviously, some of this is easy, before mobile phones, before the internet, that's easy, yeah? Before personal computers. Before phones for a lot of people. My parents got a phone in 1983. They weren't the first, but many people had phones in the 1970s. Before frozen food, yeah? Before freezers. Before central heating. Central heating was a luxury in 1970. Central heating. You're bourgeois when you had a central heating, yeah. Before a lot of things, obviously before Wikipedia and YouTube. Probably the internet is the biggest change, but there are other ones too. And other things are different too. In 1970, life expectancy for British men was 68.7 years. And for women, it was 75 years. By 2010, these figures had risen to 77.8 years for men and 81.9 years for women. And it's not a matter of memorizing all the statistics. However, if you remember a couple of them, that's always good in a dissertation, to remember a couple of statistics. That statistics are important, yeah? Now, this is quite a lot, yeah? 68? This is 6 years more. But I think there's more to it than that. It's true that in 1970... If an ordinary person you knew was 60 years old, they were old. Well, they were old. Whereas today, we don't really think they're old. I mean, it's not just that they died younger; they were also old younger. It's very important. Yeah. So, what's the changes? Well, there's been changes in medical technology. There's been changes in the way children eat. Because if you eat very badly as a child, this is bad for your body your entire life, yeah? And so the gradual things, people smoke less today, and so on, not surprising. So quite big differences there. Some more statistics. Of marriages contracted in 1970, 22% had ended in divorce before the 15th wedding anniversary. Of marriages contracted in 1995, 33%. Had ended in divorce by the 15th anniversary. Yeah, so we're in a situation where divorces are rising slowly. This was seen by some people in the 1970s, more conservative people, as a terrible thing. Yeah. Today there are many different opinions, but today it's often considered that sometimes in the 70s people stayed together who shouldn't have done. you know. It's also about the autonomy of the woman. Yeah, obviously, if you go out to work and you have a wage, it's easier to leave than if you don't have any way of making a living. In 1970, almost half of all households in the UK have a car. Okay, so almost half. Ah oui. C'est une statistique qui marche beaucoup mieux à Rouen qu'à Paris, parce qu'à Paris, il y a des riches qui n'ont pas de voiture. Parce que c'est pas la peine. Tandis qu'à Rouen, il n'y a pas de riche qui n'a pas de voiture, je crois. Moi, je ne sais pas conduire, hein. j'ai jamais appris. And in 2010, 85% will. So yeah, these are continuing changes. In 1970, 65% of households have a washing machine. That's still a lot of people without washing machines, yeah? And today, 2014, 97%. But notice from 1970 to 1980, you have the rise from 65% to 79%. So again, although we're going to look at the crisis of the 1970s, there's also a whole series of things getting better. And especially if you have five children, a washing machine is not a detail. There's a whole series of things getting better. Telephones. I sometimes get a little annoyed with people who criticize too easily. Consumer society, it's terrible, consumer society. These are normally people who have washing machines and not people who do not have washing machines. Yeah. I mean, of course, I'm not saying that none of this criticism can be justified, but you know, many of the new things we have are good things. And the number of telephones then rising very, very quickly there. And central heating gradually. That's interesting because that also had a cultural element. When I was young, not only were you considered a bit bourgeois if you had central heating, but many people considered it to be, a bad thing. You know, that, qu'est-ce que ça? It wasn't necessarily, whereas today I don't think that attitude really exists anymore. But it was, qu'est-ce que ça? Oui, alors, chauffage dans sa salle de bain. It was an interesting thing. There is a cultural thing going on here, you know. Okay, at the beginning of every year, I will give you a few statistics. Now, I could give you 25, but I don't want to give you 25 because your head will fill up and you will explode. So I give you a few statistics at the beginning of every year. There you go. So there he is, our friendly neighborhood. Oh, no, I'm going to give you some more statistics first. Infant mortality. Infant mortality was falling, and infant mortality would continue to fall. This is the number of children who die before their second birthday. That's what it is there. And we often use that as a measure, especially in poor countries. Infant mortality was falling and would continue to do so throughout the decade. In 1970, infant mortality was around 18 deaths for every 1,000. In 1980, it was 12. And today, it is 4. This is babies born alive, dying before their second birthday. So around 18 in 1970, 12 in 1980.
How many children?
1,000. Oh, out of 1,000, yeah. Not out of 10. Okay, yeah. Out of 1,000, yeah. And today it's 4. There was, in 1970, there were 2 million houses in the UK which were in fact unfit for human habitation. There was some very, very bad housing. And the report said 2 million houses were not fit to be lived in. And indeed, in 1970, if you listen to the television programmes about the election campaign, they talk a lot about slum clearance. We always have difficulty translating the word slum. Very often we use the word in French, bidonville. taudis, oui, mais un taudis, c'est un oui, donc un quartier de taudis. Une taudisserie. Voilà. Oui. Yeah. Parce que parfois on dit bidonville, mais le problème c'est que bidonville, ça fait maison fabriquée par soi-même avec de la tôle ou ce qu'on peut. Hein. Tandis que les slums, c'est vrai que c'est des quartiers de taudis. Merci. And in the 1970s, in the election campaign, they were saying, we will do much more slum clearance. Yeah? Nous allons démolir les quartiers de taudis, parce que c'était vraiment des maisons que ce n'était pas la peine de réparer. Hein. C'était des maisons qu'il fallait démolir. And so that was a big part of the election campaign. Well, today it's not, because that kind of quartier doesn't exist anymore in Britain. Although, you know, there's many places where that are in bad repair, but you're talking about places where they, you know, there are always rats and things like that, you know, really, really bad conditions.
But there are other problems like in Grenfell Tower.
No. Grenfell Tower was not a slum. Yeah, in fact, it was in bad repair. Yes,
and some corruption going on.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, yeah. It's a terrible, terrible story. In 1970, an adult woman who worked full time earned 54% what a man earned. So huge differential. In 1983, it was 66%. Okay, so 1970, 54%. 1983, 66%. So some improvement. Now, this was due to a number of factors. Sometimes women were paid less for the same job. This was not illegal. But mostly, it was simply that women's jobs were paid less. So, for example, in a company at the time, the typists, the dactylo, there were many, many typists. It was a big, there were tens of thousands of typists, and that was very badly paid. Was another job which was done by men, which required a similar level of education, was better paid. Yeah, so there was indirect discrimination. This is still a problem today, although there has been a lot of action done about it. For example, in Britain recently, there was a big campaign because they noticed that in local government, the women cleaned the offices, and men cleaned the streets. And the men cleaning the streets were paid much, much, much more than the women cleaning the offices. And they had a study about that, and they decided that one of the reasons for this was simply that it was a woman's job, and so it had always been paid less. That with the technology they were using, it was a similar kind of job, in fact. And so that they increased the women's wages in that case. But that's recently. In the 1970s, they didn't do that. In fact, the first stage of anti-discrimination legislation in the 1970s simply says it is illegal to give a different wage for the same job, which is the first step. But it's not, you know, that's not the end of the story, as stories are usually longer than we think. In 1970, 50% of all houses in the United Kingdom were owner-occupied. So 50% of people owned their own house, or as you say, there's that wonderful expression in French, en accession à la propriété. Ça veut dire endetté à la banque. Yeah? Okay, but yeah, en accession à la propriété, slowly, yeah. Now that is a lot, because in 1945... it was only 26%, so it's double. Yeah, now this is the c'est les trente glorieuses, entre autres choses. Yeah, 1970, 50%. And by 1983, it will be 60%. Yeah, so it's still rising throughout the 70s. So there's a whole series of things here which are improving during the 70s. And the reason I'm underlining it is because of the very popular discourse on the 1970s as being a decline. I'm not saying there are no elements of decline, but that you've got to see all the different sides of this. Finally, in 1970, there were 11 million trade unionists in Britain. 11 million. Something to understand about trade unions in Britain. Firstly, they have a lot more members than trade unions in France. A lot more. You know, there's never been 11 million trade unions in France. Never. But there is a reason for this, and it's not what it appears. In France, so far, if you are not a member of a union, if you work in a factory and you're not a member of a union, you can still use the union. You can elect a union member to the Comité d'entreprise. You can elect a union member as délégué du personnel. The trade union has the right to negotiate for you even if you're not a member. And one of the results of this, and also one of the reasons it was set up, is many people do not join unions. In Britain, if you're not a member of the union, you have no delegate to talk to you, there is no Comité d'entreprise, you have no representation. And so people join unions. That's one of the reasons. Yeah, that it's a different... You can't compare the number of millions in one country and the other. You can't. The second thing is that for accidental reasons, most of the trade unions in Britain are not so closely linked to a political party. Now, in France, this is different now, but certainly 20 years ago, you know, the CGT and the Communist Party were very close, and the CFDT and the Socialist Party, slightly more complicated now. And that's not been so much been the case in Britain. That is to say that the Labour Party is so wide, with some very left-wing people in it, and some people are really not very left-wing at all. It's so wide. So, it's not very... You don't really see people in Britain in the 1970s saying, oh, I'm not joining a trade union because I don't like it, it's too political. That doesn't really happen in the 1970s. So that's the reason there were 11 million trade unionists in the UK. Now, the UK was very much an industrial country in 1970, but nevertheless, in 1970, there were 1 million hectares of wheat, 15 million cows, 26 million sheep. Just symbolic things to say that, you know, British agriculture does exist. Now, it's far less important than French agriculture. And one of the big arguments, one of the reasons many British people were unhappy about joining the European Economic Community was because they considered that a lot of the money went to help agriculture. And in Britain, there wasn't very much agriculture. So they felt like they weren't getting a very good deal. So, January 1970. That's February. January 1970. From the 1st of January 1970, for the first time, you became an adult at the age of 18. Before 1970, at what age did you become an adult?
21.
Mm-hmm. 21. And it had been 21. Don't you dare do that. Sorry, I'm talking to the computer. It had been 21. The age of majority had been 21 for a very long time. There was a well-known song from 1909. 21 today, 21 today, 21, the key of the door, never been 21 before. And this represented the idea that you lived with your parents, and when you were 21, you were allowed to have your own key. But even in the 1970s, it was not unusual in the working class. You got your own key when you were 18. Huh? At the same time, this was not such a big deal because your mother and daddy never went anywhere. They never went out, you know. So remember, this is a different culture. For the working class, restaurants in the 1970s were somewhere you went for a funeral or a wedding. And that was about it. Yeah? You didn't go to you went to the pub for a couple of hours for a drink. Yeah, but restaurants now restaurants have risen tremendously. But my mother, who is 84, goes to a restaurant at least twice a month. Whereas in the 1970s, she went every 5 years when there was a funeral or a wedding, you know. So. In January 1970, the first ever female presenter on the popular music radio station, BBC Radio 1, Annie Nightingale. Annie Nightingale became the first ever female presenter on a pop music radio station. Okay, these are all these little firsts, they're actually quite important. Because Radio 1, is, you know, this is where the young people's music is, and presenting the music to the young people was only for men. from the 1940s, when it was, the first disc jockey is 1929, until 1978. For the first time, it's a woman as well. And these are quite important roles. You know, the psychology, I think these are quite important, that, you know, the young people are discovering music and, oh yeah, this is something for women and men. You know, I don't think that, these are not details. And this is also in Northern Ireland, a very violent month, and the Ulster Volunteer Force, which is a Protestant militia, set up their policy of bombing Catholic-owned shops in the Protestant parts of town. So this is what, we didn't use the expression ethnic cleansing at the time. That's a more recent expression, but that's what it was. They didn't want any Catholic shops in the Protestant parts of town. And so they planted bombs. And of course, eventually the Catholic owners left because it was just too heavy.
And were they also getting two votes, the Catholic shops and the shop owners?
Yes, they would. Yes, they would. It wasn't a direct discrimination. It was simply the fact that I don't know what percentage, but a much higher percentage of Protestants had businesses. There he is, Harold Wilson, looking quite cheerful. If we look at foreign policy, foreign policy really. In February 1970, was the Garden House Riot, a demonstration against the Greek dictatorship. A banquet was being held at the Garden House Hotel in Cambridge for friends of the Greek dictatorship. And there was a student demonstration, and as a result, 8 students were imprisoned. Now, I'm not going to tell you about every demonstration that happened in the 1970s, we'll be here all day. But I wanted to give you one or two as a symbol. Remember that 1968 is not so long ago. And of course, although 1968 in Britain did not have the importance of 1968 in France, where there were 10 million workers on strike, or in Czechoslovakia, in Prague, 1968, it was really a revolutionary situation. Nevertheless, 1968 was important in Britain. The Vietnam Solidarity Campaign had been influential. They had attacked the American embassy in London. This was the Grosvenor Square riots and that sort of thing. So there was, throughout the 1970s, there's regular student-dominated political activity, very often about world politics. Greece, apartheid in South Africa, and so on. At this time, university education was free. It was completely free in Britain. It was the golden age. And as I think I already told you, today you have to pay. In fact, my brother has started a course this week at university, and he had to pay 9,000 euros for the first year. C'est le droit d'inscription. Enfin, on dit droit de formation, parce que c'est les frais de formation, c'est les frais. It's a lot of money, isn't it? Yeah, would you pay this? It's a lot of money, isn't it? You have to. Now, this was introduced in the 1990s, yeah, so it's much, much, much later.
There's an argument, a little bit in favour. They usually have, I think UK universities probably have much more money too, better infrastructure. But if you look at the campus here,
it's not very good as they are. It's true that they do have more money and better infrastructure. Although in fact the infrastructure in the 1970s was very good, but today they do. They do have a certain number of problems, however, because apart from the fact that it's a lot of money, because they now have to stop non-students from getting into classes, because it's so expensive. Some clever students say, "Oh well, you know, these are big amphitheatres, nobody's going to notice me." Uh-huh. And so they have to pay money to have guards to stop people going to classes. And in fact, there was a journalist who went round the different universities trying to go to classes, and in half of them it was easy, and in the other half it was hard, you know. But it's just kind of amusing. Well, it's not amusing, but it's kind of a joke, really. So you have these guards and says, "How dare you want to educate yourself, you know? It's people like you that are ruining our society." Yep. 1970s then, this is still the beginning of 1970, February 1970, Black Sabbath's first album. Now, I'm not saying this because I like Black Sabbath. There is important things going on here. This is the first album which is generally recognised. Yes, I've got it. Is generally recognised as being heavy metal, and that is popular music is one of the elements where Great Britain in the 1970s was really the centre of the world. That although heavy metal was just beginning in 1970, in Britain you have heavy metal, glam rock will be the rise, and punk rock too will all come from, they're not necessarily absolute origin in Great Britain, but they will all become popular through Great Britain. And also, although it's rather unfair, reggae, which of course is from the Caribbean, will actually become known worldwide through the London, through London and the London record companies. So from a point of view of popular music, which has a certain importance, the 1970s was the glory days, you know, was the glory days. Now it's you know, you can't really say one thing is more important than another, but everything has to be in there somehow. There was also, I'm not sure what I've got here. All right, that's Rhodesia. There was also in February 1970, the first ever National Women's Liberation Conference, which was held in Oxford. The first ever British one. The British women's liberation movements. Now, there is a reason that I'm not saying feminist movements, and I'll come to that later. Partly, one of the reasons for it is that, in fact, bizarrely enough, the translation into French of the word, well, the word feminist in English does not have exactly the same meaning as the word féministe in French. Yeah, that doesn't help you, does it? I noticed this was more and more in France, it's become a very general word that all people who are against discrimination against women will accept. Whereas in Britain, it's very common for people to say, I'm against all discrimination in women and I'm not a feminist. Because feminism is taken to mean a particular analysis of women's oppression. And that's why I'm avoiding it here and saying the women's liberation movement, so which is just factual, you know. Whereas some of them will say, yes, I'm a feminist, some of them won't. Now, the 1970s is a huge time for the women's liberation movement in Britain. And it is extremely varied. One of the videos on my list is a video of feminists in Britain, and it's very interesting to watch. But you must remember that it's one example. There were 50 different kinds of activity for women's liberation in Britain in the 1970s, and it was very. There was lots of debates. People agreed, people disagreed, and very very different sorts of initiatives were taken. Sometimes there were initiatives to help what they called at the time battered wives, although what we would call today victims of domestic violence. And remember, the government was not doing anything about this, and so it was the Women's Liberation Movement who said, right, well, we're going to set up a refuge so that women have somewhere to go to. And this became quite a movement, yeah? And then other ones would say, oh, well, no, I want to do something else. Not against it, but they have a campaign saying, well, it's much more difficult for women to get books published. So let's have a publishing house which only publishes women's books. And somebody did that as well. And there were many, many different. So it's really very variegated, the women's liberation movement in Britain. And it's very difficult to measure what difference it made, because you know you can't measure it. It's molecular. But it seems to me that it had a big influence. So this National Women's Liberation Movement was held in Ruskin College, Oxford, which was an Oxford college which was founded by the trade unions. There's a link to the labour movement. The idea came from the United States. In fact, in the Vietnam War, the anti-Vietnam War movement, groups of women were gradually getting to notice that they were really not treated the same as men in the movement. And so this led to a rise of women's liberation groups in America, and they came over to Britain. And the conference defined four demands: equal pay, equal educational and job opportunities, free contraception and abortion, and free 24-hour nurseries. The last one being an interesting one because it's the only one which has kind of disappeared from history. The idea, so I'll go through them again here. Yeah, equal pay, equal educational and job opportunities, free contraception and abortion, and free 24-hour nurseries. And the last one is the one which seems to have, for the time being, disappeared from history. The idea, of course, being at the time that, you know, that very often women were being limited in their capacity to be involved in cultural or political activity because they had to look after the children. And so free 24-hour nurseries, although, you know, people would say that would be very expensive. Also in the 1970s, I think also people would have, the traditional family values were stronger, and so and so many people would have been against it for other reasons. I think they were probably stronger in Britain anyway. I think that the number of women working in France was already higher than in Britain. And so, for example, traditions like the colonie de vacances in Britain, that never took off because people thought, "Oh, you take the children away from their mothers for 3 weeks, for a month? That's cruel." In the 1970s, I'm talking, yeah, it was not considered okay. A lot of people didn't consider it to be okay. Interesting thing about the Women's Liberation Conference: the conference was mostly attended by women, but there was a minority of men. And famously, the creche was entirely staffed by men, so that women could be involved in the debates. Later in the decade, women's liberation events would often be women only. Almost all of them after 1971 were women only. But the men sometimes staffed the creche. Indeed, one Liverpool men's network specialised in providing free childcare at women's liberation events. That's the very 1970s. There's a wonderful photograph that I have somewhere of Stuart Hall, who is now a famous sociologist, at the creche at the women, looking after the children at the Women's Liberation Conference in 1970. Well, going through month by month, I'm sticking to the chronology, but trying in every case to sort of fit them into these strands. It's a bit like a soap opera. There are 10 stories at the same time, yeah? March 1970, Ian Smith declared Rhodesia to be a republic under white minority rule. So in 1966, Rhodesia had decided to become independent, but they had not made an agreement with Britain to be independent. They just said, "We are independent," because Britain would only make an agreement if they agreed for everybody to have the vote at this time. So you had what they call a unilateral declaration of independence because they wanted to preserve the white supremacy. This caused a lot of debate in Britain. A few people said, well, Britain should send the army against the white supremacist government in Rhodesia. But the government decided that would be very unpopular to be sending the army against a white government. These negotiations will continue through the 1970s with little effect. And I think it's in 1981 there will be elections, and Robert Mugabe will be elected president. One of the videos on the list, I think, is about what's happening in Rhodesia at the time, which is guerrilla warfare, and the Rhodesia white supremacist government are not very nice with their prisoners, as you can imagine. Yeah. Okay. Now the Labour government, however, refuses to recognise the new state, Rhodesia. Partly under pressure from the black countries in Africa. And this is part of the same process that after the Wind of Change speech, the British had understood that, you know, independence was the future of Africa, and there was no point in being stupid about it. And so this refusal to recognise the white Rhodesian government was part of it. Uh, And we just have time to move on to April. And in April 1970, Dr. Ian Paisley is elected to the Northern Ireland Parliament. Ian Paisley, you need to know who he is. Do you know who he is? It's him. You have an idea? Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he was one of the leaders of the Ulster Unionists, yeah, those who wanted to stay linked to the United Kingdom. He was, I think it's fair to say, an at this time, an extremist anti-Catholic politician. In 1951, he had founded his own church, the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster, and written anti-Pope pamphlets. He became famous in 1956 because he met a 15-year-old girl who was a Catholic, and the girl said that she wanted to become a Protestant. And so he smuggled her out of the country so that she could live with a Protestant family. And then the Catholic parents complained, and the judge decided that the Catholic girl was in danger if she returned to her parents because she decided to be a Protestant. Yeah, so this is basically racism. Yeah. It's basically anti-Catholic racism. It's not anything else. But that's the kind of complexity that you got involved with. And so he actually considered that the dominant church was allowed to kidnap the children of Catholic families. You can imagine that this did not help the relations between Catholics and Protestants. Yeah, it really is a very, very tense situation. I think you've got to think about the south of the United States. You remember it was the anniversary recently of the first black girls who went to a mixed race school, and that the level of hatred was, you know, and it's that kind of situation. It's sort of really extremely blocked people who sometimes move but sometimes don't. You know. And finally for today, in 1970, the Ulster Special Constabulary, the B Specials, were disbanded. Now, who were the B Specials? The B Specials were part-time police. They were almost all Protestants, and they were well known for mistreating the Catholic population. In 1969, however, they went too far, and they shot a number of Catholics just because they were Catholics. And so the British government decided to disband them. There was an official inquiry into the B Specials, and they said, I quote, "Although recruitment is open to both Protestant and Roman Catholic, in practice we are in no doubt that it is almost, if not wholly impossible, for a Roman Catholic recruit to be accepted." Okay, so we've only got as far as April 1970. But I'm hoping that, you know, that we're going to get the chronologicals and also put them into the different strands. My plan for you is that basically until Christmas, you just need to absorb the maximum of information. Then after Christmas, you think about methodology and so on. Yeah. So I do encourage you to find time to watch some of these videos. Videos are a little bit easier than reading history books. So, you know, you need to just get information in there so that you have something to bring out when you need it. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm now